And we're back, and now we're transitioning to the second section on Professor Garden, Beginnings of the Arts in the Small Community, which of course leads us to the question, how did you hear about Professor Garden? Tell us about that first meeting when you went off to meet him.
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, Professor Kreitlow and Thede and Boyd decided to make experiences available to me. And one of the people they suggested that I talk to was Professor Gard. I had no idea who he was in my early experiences with WHA. It didn't happen that I ever knew about Wisconsin at my doorstep. I didn't know about his show, so I didn't know who he was. So I went to his office, which was on the 7th floor of the Extension Building, and I sat down, and his secretary, Aura Berry, who became my great friend for the whole rest of the time I was in Madison, Aura said, "Well, the professor will be with you in a moment. He's talking to his publisher." Well, here I was, steps away from a man who had his own New York publisher. And so I sat down and was waiting, and then Aura started talking to me. And she said, "I'm screening the contestants for the writing awards for Wisconsin Regional Writers at the moment." She said, "There's this playwright here from Milwaukee who has written this play," and she said, "I don't know how they'd ever perform it because he has the main character urinating 7 times on stage." And she said, "I don't even understand how anybody could have come." She obviously didn't know me today, but this was for a 21-year-old from Central Wisconsin. This was pretty heady stuff, you know. And so then Professor Gard got off the long distance call, and I was invited into his office. And so first of all, there was a big pile of papers on the chair, and I had to remove that and sat down. And here was this man, just about as unassuming as anybody you could imagine. Hair kind of slicked back and a few warts and kind of a rumpled suit. And then he started to talk to me. And when he found out that I was able to contribute 10 hours a week for free, he was all over it like an old coat. And so the first thing he said was, "Well, you know," he said, "it occurred to me that maybe you could keep a journal, and maybe we could get a book out of that. I could add some things, and we might be able to get a book out of that." Well, my God, you know, I mean, it was just, you know, like red meat to me. I thought this would be a great idea. And they said, "No," he said, I want you to start out by working on a project that we've got going here." He said, "The Madison Civic Club is having its 50th anniversary," and he said, "I'd like you to help me with that." So what happened was what I found typical of him when I worked for him. He would just throw you into something. He never made the assumption that people couldn't do a job. He just threw it at you. And so I started attending the rehearsals for this. This also is illustrative of the fact that he never said no to anybody. Now, why on earth he would have been doing the show for the Madison Civic Club's 50th anniversary, who knows? It was because somebody asked him. Plus, the professor had a real talent for making connections. And he knew full well that this civic club, being the female leaders of Madison and most of the senior faculty's wives, was an important thing to do. So the chairman of the show was a woman named Constance Elvium, whose husband, Conrad Elvium, was the president of the university while I was an undergraduate. and it just recently passed away. So the ladies of the Civic Club decided this would be a lovely thing for Connie to do, because it would give her something to occupy her time. Well, she would call me up in the evening with some business about the show, and we would end up talking for an hour, because she was, you know, she was just terribly lonely. Her children were grown, and he was gone. Well, I mean, for this little nobody, 21-year-old graduate student, to be in conversation daily with the president's wife at the university, I mean, this was amazing. And that was pretty much throughout my years of experience with Professor Gard. I was always getting to meet people that I mean, Governor Knowles, Lee Strasberg, I mean, all kinds of people that he had contact with and had cultivated. So, yeah, that was my first meeting, you know, getting thrown right into a job.
What were you actually doing for the Civic celebration? Were you producing the show? Kind of the gopher? What was that involved?
Well, kind of the gopher is putting it pretty accurately. I did the scut work. I did the running around and see. Then the show that Fress had written was pretty much based around the women's suffrage movement in Wisconsin. So there was a scene with a suffragette parade near the end, and there was a town drunk that had to be accosted and put out of the way. So guess who got to play the town drunk? But what that meant was that, of all things, I was acting, quote unquote, I was acting on the main stage at the University of Wisconsin Theater. I never in my wildest dreams did I expect that would ever happen to me.
The shy guy from Dalesville.
Yeah.
That's true. So Mike, there are so many different projects that Professor Gard was involved with. Could you take us through a list and tell us a little bit about
them? Sure, I'd be happy to. I hasten to say that there were a great number of things that he was involved with before I came on the scene, and things afterwards. I mean, there was always, we always had too much work and too little staff and too little money and too little time. I mentioned earlier that he directed the show for the Milwaukee Folk Fair, and that was one of the things that he helped me with. Now, I have no idea if the Folk Fair is still in existence or not. I don't know. But it used to be a huge event. It was in the Milwaukee Arena Auditorium. And the show involved everybody. I mean, it was like a cast of thousands. All the different ethnic groups that had dance groups or that had choruses or whatever, all had to be worked into the story. And the play took place on the floor of the Arena Auditorium in Milwaukee, an enormous space. And Professor Gard would sit way up in the high rows and, "Oh, Mike, tell them that they need to be moving over in that direction instead of this direction." So I'd scurry down and give them the blocking and come back up again. And I don't know how he originally got involved with that. But he did that at that time. And then, you know, as I was thinking about, as I was preparing for this interview, I began to think about the things that I don't know. Like, I remember working with him on the Folk Fair maybe twice, and then he didn't seem to do it anymore. So I don't know what happened or what passed on, but there are a number of things like that were kind of part of the fabric of the community or the Wisconsin Idea Theater office that suddenly kind of went away. And I don't know the ins and outs of why that would have happened. I don't think there was anything sinister about it, but anyway, he stopped doing it. He also had founded something was called Wisconsin Idea Theater Conference. And this was a gathering of all the community theater groups in the state for an annual conference somewhere. And there'd be workshops on directing, workshops on blocking, workshops on acting, and so on. And at that time, it was the biggest organization of its type in the country, a meeting ground for community theater people. And we worked with that a couple of times. And that's another one of those things that I, in the latter years I was there, I worked with GARD about 6 years. And in the latter years I was there, I don't remember hearing any mention of the Wisconsin Idea Theater Conference. So I don't know what happened there. And I guess that's really one of the things that typifies Professor GARD and Wisconsin Idea Theater, that he was like that guy in the Bible that throws the seeds, and sometimes they land on fertile ground and sometimes they don't, and sometimes they take off on their own volition. He was very much into starting things and then kind of backing out and letting people take their way on. The one place that he didn't do that was Wisconsin Regional Writers, which now is going on 60 years, I think, in existence. It's a group of about 2,000 writers from all over the state that gather twice a year for a huge conference. And then also we used to have, and I don't know if they still do or not, we had local chapters. And then for people in rural areas, we had what was called round robins. And someone would send a manuscript to somebody else, and then it would go to somebody else, and then somebody else. So there'd be about six sets of critiques, and they'd send those back. Now, if they still have that, I suppose they do it all on internet now. I mean, of course they would. But it was a great thing for the state. And something that in which people had great interest, and I didn't realize how unique some of these things are to Wisconsin until I left the state and discovered that there was nothing. Now there is in state of Washington, there's something kind of like Wisconsin Regional Writers, but Indiana there was nothing like that, and I don't know about other states, but it was a unique thing and it was very exciting. The spring conference especially was a very exciting thing. We had agents and editors from New York, always noted writers that would give speeches. We had it actually several times. We had it in this building, the Wisconsin Center, and it was a great encouragement to writing in the state. And again, I didn't realize that the effects of this until a few years ago when I retired. I had done a lot of writing, and I had kind of I made a great mistake in that I decided that I was going to be a famous writer. Now, the details of that I didn't work out. I just was going to do it. So I started writing all kinds of things, trying to write to the market and so on. And I did end up publishing some things, but I turned it into a job. And so it ceased being a creative outlet for me. It became work. And so I really lost it as a writer. So when I retired, I was going to try to get that back. So I went to some writing workshops around the country, and I came to one at the Old Baptist Assembly in Green Lake. And it was three writers from Madison who were conducting the class. And it was packed. I mean, there were like 100 or 200 people there. And I thought, where else in the country could you assemble this number of people who were just wanting to write? And it's absolutely because of the work of Wisconsin Regional Writers being knitted into the fabric of the state that makes this possible. Another organization just like that that we helped start while I was working with Professor Gard was Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets, which I believe is still ongoing. And that was a great help to a lot of the writers in the state. We did Wisconsin Trail of Nations, which was kind of akin to the sort of work you do for the Arts Board. We brought together leaders of various ethnic performing groups around the state and had an association of those people. One of the things that, in connection with that I took part in was every summer, Professor Gard would mount a series of ethnic group shows in Camp Randall Stadium. And we would bring in performing groups from around the state to do an evening performance. And so I was involved with that. I remember one time that Professor Gard decided that he needed somebody to carry the flag when the show started, have a patriotic opening. And he decided that I should carry the flag. Well, you remember that this was the mid-60s, and there weren't a lot of us around here who were very much interested in carrying a flag. And so I did everything I could to argue my way out of it. And I was going to be the flag bearer. And so I did it with great reluctance and gritted my teeth and went through it. Later on, something was said about I carried the flag at the performance, and Professor Gard said, "Yeah," he said, "and you were the worst flag bearer that there ever was. It was pitiful." Yeah. But just some neat experiences out of that. I remember one time there were Basque dancers from somewhere in northwestern Wisconsin, and their director was the local priest, and they arrived in Madison in a Greyhound bus that they chartered, and in the middle of the front of the bus was this huge cooler filled with bottles of booze, and they've all been drinking all the way to Madison. And so we got them installed in a motel on the east side, and I called up two or three times to make sure that they were doing all right, and I'd hear the pool splashing in the background, and so I'm singing going on and everything. Well, I was petrified. I mean, I figured that they would all have passed out by the time it came for the performance. They came on and did a great job, you know, no problem at all. Another time, we had a Welsh chorus from somewhere. Where are the Welsh sections? Is New Glarus?
Yeah,
where?
Southwest.
Yeah, so yeah. Yeah, they were from over that way somewhere. And these people arrived wearing just clothes. I mean, they were just people. There were no uniforms, anything like that. Nothing to distinguish them as a chorus. And that night it rained, so we had the show in the field house instead of outside. And the audience was sitting in bleachers along one side of the field house, and the performers were sitting on the other side. And this Welsh group was sitting there among the crowd. And when it came time for them to sing, they simply started singing and then got up and came down off the bleachers and across the floor to stand in front of the audience singing the whole time. Nice. It was just transporting, amazing. And then I mentioned earlier Lee Strasberg. Professor Gard, made contact with Lee Strasberg of the Actors Studio and talked him into coming out here to doing a workshop a week-long workshop for the community theater people of the state. Mm. So we're at Dominican College in Racine, and we had people from all over Wisconsin getting instruction from the man who trained Marilyn Monroe and everybody else at that point. Lee Strasberg was a big name. So I got to spend a week with Lee Strasberg and asking him totally inappropriate questions like, your daughter just recently posed nude for Playboy magazine. What do you think about that? And which he answered with great aplomb. He said, my daughter has a beautiful body and she has the right to show it off. But, you know, to spend a week with someone of Lee Strasberg's stature is just an amazing opportunity. I helped with the early years of the Rhinelander School of the Arts, which is, as we record this, they're celebrating their 51st season at this point. Rhinelander School of the Arts is a summer workshop that takes place in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, in the northern part of the state, and has continued to be a success for all these years. I think my biggest, most life-changing experience with Professor Gard was the National Finnish American Festival in Hurley, Wisconsin. As I said, I started working with Gard because my professors in adult education knew that I needed some experience in the field. So one day I came into the office, I think by this time we were in the basement of Ag Hall, and Gard said, you know, he said, I have an idea. He said, there are some folks up in the northern part of the state, up at Hurley, and they want to start a Finnish American festival. And I thought maybe you could go up there for a year and help them plan it. Well, point number one, in those days, Hurley had an incredible reputation in the state. Everybody that ran for statewide office ran on the platform that they were going to clean up Hurley. Because Hurley had bars, it had live entertainers who did a lot of specialized entertaining, and was really that guy. They used to say, there are three places in Wisconsin: Hayward, Hurley, and Hell. And Hell is the mildest of all. And then plus the idea of being uprooted and going to the far north was. I don't think that my major professor would approve of that. I said, I'm here on this fellowship. And so he said, I've talked to them, it's all arranged. And so I moved up to Hurley, Wisconsin. I bought a house in Montreal, which is about 5 miles out of Hurley, and it was the company town for one of the shaft iron mines. And of course, the iron mines had gone out of business. So I was able to buy the house for $2,500. And payments of $21 a month, including taxes and insurance. So I moved up there and started working with the Finnish American people starting the festival. Well, as I said, the idea was that we were to plan it the first year, and then they would start holding the festival the next year. And when we went up to a meeting of the board, they made it very clear that they were going to start right now. And so suddenly my job description was entirely different. And I don't believe I've ever worked that hard in my life other than that time. 16, 18 hours a day. And we mounted a festival, which included a museum with 1,000 items, all of which had been gathered by people on the various committees by going around and talking to everybody they knew. We had a cabin setting, interior cabin. We had an old-fashioned smoke sauna with a mannequin standing in it draped modestly in a towel, which didn't have as much to do with modesty as it had to do with not wanting people to see that she divided in two right at the middle. We had an auditorium where we had our entertainment by local talent. We had a little restaurant where we served coffee and baked goods, usually with cardamom seed, and started a radio program, the Finnish Radio Hour, that played every Sunday. A lot of people had Finnish collections, Finnish records, and so we played those records. And the story went around that people were no longer dying at the old folks' homes because they all had to stay alive until next Sunday to hear the next Finnish Radio Hour. And we had a craft shop in downtown with local craftsmen and a weaver in the front window. And Jim Schwalbach and his wife, Till, came up and helped set up a silk screen workshop where we would silk screen finished designs to make aprons and tote bags and so on. They eventually built a Finnish culture center out on Highway 2. And directly after we finish here, I'm driving up to Hurley to speak at their 50th anniversary celebration. They now have a headquarters and an outdoor museum that where they brought in buildings from local farms and have them set up as a park kind of museum. And I learned so much there, and really gained valuable experience in starting something and working with community people. The thing that struck me most about it, and still does, is what I saw happen to individuals there. Because they mentioned the radio show. There was a couple who became radio celebrities as a result of this thing. They were heard all over the range, and they ran this program for a number of years. I mean, people who had no background or experience in that kind of thing whatsoever. There was one woman, Lempi Saari, who was a very retiring widow who never spoke above a whisper, and she took over as the guide in the museum and led people through the exhibits and talked to them all about the Finnish heritage and what the objects were used for and so on. Another woman, Irene Nevila, who was started the restaurant, had no managerial experience whatsoever, but she managed this group of people who prepared things for smorgasbords and coffee socials and the daily stuff at the museum. It was quite interesting to see how a project like that enriched people's lives. And I really think that that's the basis of what all this community development in the arts is about, is what its effect is on individuals. It's something in my opinion, we don't study nearly enough.
Can you talk some about what was the underlying philosophy, the reason that Professor Gard was involved with all of these kinds of projects?
Sure. Yeah, perhaps we could do that after a short break.
Absolutely.
All right. I'm.
Okay. So,
back after break, and wanted to ask a couple of follow-up questions before we go into the larger philosophy. The name of the couple who were the radio hosts on the Finnish Radio Hour?
I'm glad you asked.
Who changed people's lives?
Yeah, they were very important. Gene and Enda Kompsi, who live in Kimball, which is a suburb of Hurley. They were perfectly wonderful people. They adopted me. I spent more time at their house than I did at my own. while I was up there. They were tireless supporters of the National Finnish American Festival and kept things going with it during a period when the board became very discouraged and really helped move it along and make it happen. Highly intelligent people, neither of whom had a college education, and that taught me something. Because I realized, I guess that's one of the big things I learned during that Hurley experience, that in most cases, the letters people have behind their names mean nothing. You know, that there's an awful lot more to people than where they went to school. And Gene and Enda were wonderful, generous people that were just, there's not a day goes by that I don't think of them.
Hmm. That's terrific. And so such a rich experience, that as well as these others. We were going to talk about what helped create that. What was the grounding philosophy that structured and shaped these programs?
Well, I would guess that a lot of it came from Professor Gard himself. I've known many incredibly remarkable people in my life. I fear that a lot of people don't meet remarkable people. And I feel so fortunate that I've been able to meet people that were important. I suppose the most remarkable person I've ever met is my spouse, who is remarkable in that he's managed to stick with me for 44 years. But Professor Gard is really head and shoulders above anybody else, and principally because of his philosophy. For one thing, as I may have mentioned earlier, I know I mentioned earlier, he never said no to a request. Never said no. Always dived in with university resources to help whoever needed help getting something started. He believed very firmly, and his programs reflected the belief that artistic expression is a basic human right. The arts belong to everybody and don't belong in an ivory tower. They should be part of the fabric of life. He had a total scattergun approach. You know, as I said earlier, it was a matter of throwing out the seed to see what grew. And that was a very freeing, very inclusive kind of experience, that the whole state was the territory of the university. He truly believed that the borders of the state were the borders of the university. He had boundless energy. I don't know, I mean, I can't imagine how he did the things he did. You know, there were all these organizations that he started that are going over 50 years later. He managed to publish 40 books. He managed to study and become an Episcopal priest with all this other thing going on. Amazing energy, out for at least four nights a week, out on the road at meetings, getting home at 11 o'clock and being in the office at 8 o'clock the next morning. He also believed, and this is something else that I mentioned earlier, he also believed that anybody could do anything. And as I said, he would assign tasks and then let you do the task. And if you failed at it, that wasn't so bad. But he believed that the most of people, the best of people. also, he had, I was going to say no respect, but that's not true. It's not strong enough. He had absolute contempt for organizational rules and fiscal rule. We were constantly in trouble. And because of that, I used to think sometimes it would be just easier to follow the procedures rather than do all the creative things he ended up coming with to circumvent the procedures. But I believe that that made it possible for a lot more to be accomplished, you know, to do the job and let the pieces fall where they may. A lot of the times they fell on me. But I think that philosophy philosophy of inclusion, of the arts being the property of every citizen in a democracy, was really what informed a lot of these projects, or all of the projects, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier how your philosophy has grown out of this. Do you want to expand on that?
Sure. Remember I said earlier that that I was very impressionable and naive at the time. I picked up the liberal philosophy of the University of Wisconsin without really knowing it. And the same thing happened when I worked at Wisconsin Idea Theater, that it seemed so obvious to me and so logical that this concept of the arts belonging to people, particularly when there's public money involved, that's, I don't remember adopting that kind of philosophy, it just was. I mean, it just made great sense. And as a result, when I left Wisconsin and went to work in other places, was when I discovered that everybody didn't feel that way. And that there were people, and I'm afraid there still are, who think of the arts as something sacred, something which can only be practiced by a select few, that are to be actively or inadvertently shielded from the masses. I ran into some severe problems working in the Indiana Arts Commission and thereafter, because my philosophy didn't match other people's philosophy. I believe very strongly that one of the problems we have in the field of arts development is the definition of arts. I believe there are as many definitions of art as there are people defining it. And some people define it very differently from the way other people define it. And yet we all act as though we're doing the same thing and aiming for the same goals. And it simply is not true. As time goes by, I become more and more radical, not that it makes any difference to anybody, but in my own mind, I become more and more radical in my belief in artistic expression as a human right. I've reached the place where I believe firmly that arts institutions, the way they are constituted and managed nowadays, are absolute anathema to the arts. I believe that arts institutions, and I shouldn't generalize, many arts institutions are responsible for the arts retaining a peripheral role in our society. Art museums are deliberately built as temples where the unwashed masses I'm made to feel uncomfortable both by the surroundings and by the personnel. I believe that opera companies have become nothing but museums that are running 19th century programs for an increasingly aging population. I feel the same way about symphony orchestras. And all of this would be fine. All of this would make no difference if they didn't keep monies from going to community arts programs and programs based on artistic expression. The whole idea that the arts should be practiced by a few people and viewed with adoration by the rest is simply not in line with what happens in the real world. We have enormous arts programs going on. We have a music industry, we have the film industry, we have popular fiction and other writing, et cetera, et cetera. Because those things are make money and because they're designed to turn a profit, they automatically are considered not to be arts. That in order to be an arts organization, you must be starving. You must always be looking for money. And it's moved the arts to a rarefied, the arts in the strictest sense of the word, to a peripheral role in our society. I mean, I don't understand how museums, symphony orchestras, opera companies, dance companies, it's as though they have a death wish. You know, they run programs which they refer to as outreach, which by definition is condescending. Instead of really involving the population and really working to make the arts a part of people's lives. I believe that the National Endowment for the Arts has gotten into the problems it has with funding and so on because they chose the direction of funding institutions rather than community and state programs. If they had picked up our lead with the Arts in a Small Community Project, one of our hopes was that the endowment would take a stronger role in community arts development. If they had done that, can you imagine the constituency that there would be now? Nobody in Congress would dare to speak against the programs if their constituents were telling them otherwise. I think we've taken a real wrong direction in that way. And thank goodness for the work that people like the Wisconsin Arts Board, the Wisconsin Idea Theater Foundation, community arts specialists at state arts agencies across the country. Thank goodness for the work that they're doing, because it really means that the arts might not only survive but thrive, but it's absolutely an uphill battle. Didn't mean to go on and on like that.
Actually, I think this would be a moment to just take another little break, because I think that's really profound, and I'd like to catch my breath and just think about what you've said for a moment. So could we just take a little pause?
Okay.
So you're in Hurley, and it sounds like at this point you could have done many things, but you did get a PhD, right?
Yes.
And that's what you'd come to the university to do. So tell us just a bit about what your PhD thesis was. Was it on the Hurley experience, and what were your perspectives?
Yeah, that it was. That's was the carrot that the professor held out to me, was that I could gather my research data while I was up there. And so I did. I can't remember the title of my thesis, but it's like 27 words long. I've got it written down here somewhere, but I don't know where it is right now. The gist of it was the effects of a cultural arts festival on a community like that. And so I did interviews with a great number of people about why they took part in the festival, and tested 11 variables, and did a lot of statistical tests, which I frankly didn't understand, and came up with a conclusion, a startling conclusion, that the one factor that governed people's participation was whether they were Finnish or not. But it was the first
earth-shattering.
Yeah, but it was the first. It was the first research of its kind at that time, and which made it easier on me in one respect, in that the review of the research was very short.
Great. So, was it at about this time? Because for the next conversation, this period of conversation, we're going to be talking about the Arts in the Small Community program that you've referred to. And so, with your thesis behind you, Harv, do you want to just sort of segue us into the conversation?
Yes, it's kind of a transition, I think, Mike, because what we're curious about hearing more about is the National Endowment for the Arts coming into existence, the grants program that people were hearing about all over the country. So were you and Bob drawn to that because money was available, or had the community arts development movement already propelled you forward and you matched your work here to a grant application?
Well, both are true. Both are true. When I came back from Hurley, I went back to work for Professor Gard again, and then shortly thereafter, he applied for and received the 3-year grant from the National Endowment. And at that point, he asked me to join the faculty and coordinate the grant. For Mario to say that my thesis was behind me isn't exactly true, because I actually went on faculty before I finished writing the dissertation. And as I've indicated, Professor Gard's method of working was that everybody was constantly overloaded with work. And so I simply was unable to do any more writing. And it was sliding on and on. And finally, one day, he called me into his office. He said, look, he said, I got you an assistant professorship on the basis that you'd have a degree. And so he said, I want you to take a month, go up to your house in Montreal, and finish writing that paper. And so I did, and then shortly after that did my orals and got my degree in January of 67. So both things, as you were saying, both things were true. The endowment money was available, and it matched the kind of work that we were doing, or not yet matched. They opportunity matched the kind of work we were doing. The endowment came into being in 1965, I think. And the man who was in charge of community programs at that time, as you no doubt know, thanks to Jacob Javits, the way the legislation was set up was that each state was to receive an amount of money annually from the endowment. And so the man who was in charge of those state and community programs was a man named Charlie Mark. Now it happened, he was from Bayview in Milwaukee and had worked with Professor Gard in the past, and Gard had helped him get his first novel published. So they had a kind of an affinity. And so Mark suggested to Gard that perhaps he would want to apply for a grant. So Professor Gard put together, and I don't know who he consulted with on this, I wasn't involved with the application, but I put together a rather grandiose proposal of a three-year program to study what would happen if resources were brought to bear on small communities to help them develop arts programs and develop an arts life in their community. So he sent in the application, and part of it was the way he selected the communities was based on work that was already starting to happen in some of the communities, like, for instance, Rhinelander, because of Rhinelander School of the Arts. Spring Green, because the Uplands Arts Council had begun forming and was trying to develop new programs. Portage, because there were plans underway there for a theater that would be a tourist attraction and present plays having to do with the pioneer experience and people going through that area on their way west. And Waupun, people from Waupun had approached him about starting an arts council and wanted to get things going, so there was a germ of something there. And then the fifth community was Adams Friendship, which was no place and had nothing. And so I've always thought that he probably included that as kind of a cosmic joke, that if we could make something happen there, it certainly could happen anywhere. And so he sent in the proposal. And everything I'm going to say from now on depends on folklore, because I didn't witness any of it. But apparently when it came before the National Council for the Arts, on the Arts, people were openly contemptuous about this. That this, of course, wasn't really art and wasn't the kind of thing they were to be doing. Apparently Isaac Stern, the violinist, came out in favor of the program. And then Leonard Bernstein, now I'm getting some of this from Charlie Mark's autobiography, which was called Reluctant Bureaucrats. And Mark stated there that Leonard Bernstein arrived late at the meeting, and when he came in and found out how people were acting toward this proposal, he said, don't you understand, this is the kind of thing we should be doing. This is what it's about. This is what we should be doing. And the proposal passed. And so that was how the grant came about.
So I'm holding in my hands a copy of Reluctant Bureaucrats, and I'm looking at that very description. And Bernstein most eloquently described the need to break out of the elite image the arts now hold, to make the arts available to all our citizens wherever they reside, building audiences by introducing people to the complexity of the arts through hands-on experience and the nurturing of latent talent, how artists are discovered in the most unlikely places. Was that kind of the big philosophical notion behind the whole idea, kind of in the context that you were talking about earlier?
I suppose you could say so, yeah. The professor had done a little research and discovered that a quarter of the population of the country lived in rural areas, and that most of those areas and most of those little communities were basically unserved by the arts. And he wanted to see what would happen if they were served. That was the basic philosophy of it.
So right now, Americans for the Arts will chart that there were, that 10 years ago, there were maybe 1,500 arts councils, and 5 years ago, 2,500 arts councils, and I don't know how many arts councils they're saying that there are now. The last figure I heard was 4,000 or 5,000. What was it, it kind of gives us a picture of what it was like arts council-wise in the 1960s, especially in small communities.
It was very bleak. When we started out, the only arts councils that I was really aware of were one in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and one in Minneapolis, one in the Quad Cities area of Southern Illinois. And there were other organizations that probably didn't call themselves arts councils, but served that function, you know, but they were few and far between. And as far as I know, and this is a totally uninformed opinion, but as far as I knew, there were no such things as small community arts councils at that point. So it was pretty much virgin territory. And I in preparing for this interview, preparing for this interview has been a very illuminating experience, because when you're 73 and suddenly are called upon to reflect upon your whole life, it's a really daunting task. There were no community arts councils to speak of. The state arts councils were just coming into being. New York was pretty advanced because they had state monies in a good amount. But the other state arts councils were just starting to find their way a little bit.
So was there a Wisconsin Arts Board at this time?
It was either shortly thereafter, I think. When did it start, George?
So the Arts Board came into being in 1973.
Oh, that late?
That late. We were one of the last states to have an arts council. Now, there was another entity, however, that I think Art was involved with, which mm-hmm. predated the Arts Board.
Mm-hmm. Council.
Council for the Arts. Council for the Arts.
I'm trying to remember the guy who was the director. I can see his face, but I can't remember what his name was.
For the council?
Yeah.
I don't know if he was a director, but Jerry Bartell was somebody who was
involved in that. Oh, yeah, Jerry Bartell. It's Chapter a Day. Jerry Bartell, I think, was the chairman at that point. I won't tell my Jerry Bartell story.
So you're painting a picture of a landscape with not very many community arts institutions, no real state arts agency at the time. So it was sort of the arts extension people that were the infrastructure for the arts in Wisconsin. Is that correct?
I would have to say that, yes. That's largely true. And I don't know what was going on in other states, because I believe that the early emphasis on the arts and extension in Wisconsin was fairly unique. There was a incredible dean of agriculture who brought in the first John Stuart Curry as the first artist in residence at any university, I believe. And he was housed in the School of Agriculture. And also developed early on this whole, brought Gard in 1945, started this whole concept of rural arts development through the School of Agriculture and the Cooperative Extension Service. So really, when you think about that, it's really monumental.
So it's totally appropriate that this test program should be in Wisconsin, that it really follows from the work of the university over decades and decades.
Well, yeah, but I would say that, wouldn't I? I believe that to be true. Yeah.
So there weren't very many arts councils. What was it that you were testing? You keep referring to the test communities, test communities. What was the idea that you were testing?
Well, as I said, we were trying to see what would happen if resources were brought to bear in small communities. And we divided the grant into three segments by years. The first segment was bringing in entertainment and exhibits and so on from outside the community. And from the beginning, we thought the idea of a community arts council was the way to go. And so we spent that first year making contacts in the community, helping them start local arts organizations, and bringing in materials from outside. The second year was concentrated on helping the local artists and the local activities develop and get the Arts Council set up in such a way that if they wanted to bring in things, we still had things available to them, but we let them initiate the requests for those things. And then the third year was concentrated, and when I say concentrated, I don't mean that we didn't do the other things. we did both and just added to it. And the third year was our reporting, putting together our findings and making them available.
Mike, taking a step back, when you say the establishment of the community arts councils, from where were you guys getting the models? Where were you bringing that information in?
You know, it beats the heck out of me. I wish I could tell you that. It must have been based on what the professor knew about what was happening in places like Winston-Salem and Quincy, Illinois, and so on. I don't know. I know that we always referred to them as arts councils. Whether he made up the idea that they'd be appropriate to small communities or not, I'm not sure. But from the very beginning, we thought that was the way to go. I suppose we could just as easily have called them something else, you know, but we called them arts councils.
Well, you described that you were at this time housed in Ag Hall, so you would have been surrounded by some of the cooperative extension agents doing their field work, and then you were trained by them.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like this is kind of an extension model, of an agent working to help local people build their own infrastructure.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So is that maybe from the extension model?
Yeah. Yeah. That, at least in part, I'm sure that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So, see, we kind of got shoved around from pillar to post. You know, when I started with Professor Gard, he was with University Extension. And then because he was very hard for the bureaucracy to deal with, they finally pawned him off on the School of Agriculture. And so we were part of the Department of Ag and Extension Education. And we were located on the second floor of Agriculture Hall, right in the same area as the people that did cooperative extension education. So yeah, that model was very basic to what we were standing for.
Could you tell us a little bit more about what you actually did in some of those communities? I believe you were in charge of two of the communities, weren't you? Didn't you get part, each of you in the program get kind of assigned to?
Well, for the first year, for the first year, I was assigned to all the five communities, and we agreed pretty much that we wouldn't be as active in Rhinelander because it was so far away, for one thing, and also because the thrust of the program at that time was the already existing Rhinelander School of the Arts. So we kind of let that be. But I went into the other four communities the first year.
So when you went into them, for example, in that year, what did you do? Whom did you meet with? What did you talk about? Did they call you? Did you call them? What was the way you worked?
Well, in Spring Green, of course, they had started the Uplands Arts Council. And the moving force in that was a man named Robert Graves. And so he pretty well set up things where we'd meet there. Other places, like I remember distinctly Waupun and Portage, we started through the county agent. The county agent called together community leaders who were interested in the arts, and we met with them to begin with. The people in Portage came up with a wonderful idea, which I've always thought should be replicated in many communities. The wife of the local newspaper publisher was in the group that was starting the Arts Council there. And they developed, and he ran in the paper, a little questionnaire. What are you interested in the arts? And then it had various possibilities, and people would check that off and put their name on it and send it in. And it was amazing. Immediately we had lists, you know, of people who could start a writing group, who could start a painting group, who could start a whatever. And we did that then, because they had done it, we did it in the other communities. It was a wonderful little tool, because it immediately identified core people who were interested. And so as time went by, it became more and more refined, and more people became involved. And then we would meet with those specific, like there was a very active writing group in Adams Friendship, and I would go up and meet with them. And I was in Wisconsin Regional Writers and doing quite a bit of writing, particularly poetry at the time. And so I would go up and help them critique in their meetings and so on. And then we would have public gatherings, like we had Professor Michael Church come from University of Michigan. Church was a great visual arts advocate for communities around the state of Michigan. And he came in and we would gather a group of people and he would give a lecture on art appreciation. And so that sort of thing. It was all kinds of activities to bring people together and bring people in and get them working toward one end.
That's wonderful. Why don't we take a little break here, lunchtime, and catch our breath, and we'll be back in an hour.
This will be a good place to reconvene, in right where we are.
Yeah.
Excellent place.